Brunnen, and then up onto the cliff edge above that, along to Murren, and there to stand looking out across the spectacular range of those three great mountains, the Jungfrau, the Munch, and the Eiger. Now, if you're a camera enthusiast, as our family is, you can't stop taking photographs, unless, of course, they happen to be covered with clouds, but let's imagine they're not. And so you take in the whole range, but then any photographer is more interested to put on his long throw lens and to concentrate, perhaps focusing in on the Eiger, looking at some of the rock formations, at people climbing up the north face, or the helicopter rescuing some of them, and gradually focusing in on one detail of the whole picture. Now, in Daniel chapter 2 to 7, we stood and looked at the panorama. Now, from chapter 8 to the end of the book, we're focusing all the way now, and focusing in on some of the parts that we've looked at already, but looking at them in closer detail and learning deeper lessons. That's what's happening to us as we come to Daniel 8. And what we're looking at, verse 17 tells us, and indeed other verses as well, is a vision for the time of the end. And I hope that as you come at it this morning, and as we look at it together, we won't say, well, this is past history, because the book of Revelation makes it quite clear that what Daniel is teaching is a vision for the end. And it's in that sense that we shall look at it this morning. Two ways. First, the vision and its interpretation, and then the vision and its application. First then, the vision and its interpretation. Now here we have no guesswork to be applied. In some of the recent parts of Daniel we've been looking at, we've said it might be this, it might be that. But if you've read this chapter before today, as I hope you have, then you'll know that in verses 1 to 14 we have the vision, and in verses 18 to 26 we have the explanation. So no guesswork required. All you need is a finger in these church Bibles to keep going backwards and forwards, to handle the two sections together. Now he starts in verses 1 and 2 with a very human introduction. He suddenly begins to realize he's got a vision coming on. You sort of feel it's like that. He suddenly begins to think, hey, I'm beginning to have a vision. And then he gets it geographically set in Susa, Persia. And then he begins to see the content of the vision and its meaning. Now let's follow the vision through. Firstly, in verses 3 to 4, he has this vision of the two-horned ram. I think most people are well aware that the symbol of the horn was a symbol of power and authority. In some expressions of that authority, people actually bound a horn onto their forehead. Indeed, even in some of the Druze families, there is the habit of the lady who heads the household wearing a small silver horn on her forehead. This, therefore, is a symbol of authority. And the ram was very much connected with Persia, and sometimes, instead of a crown, the king wore an actually golden head of a ram made in gold, and this was a sign of his power. So the horns and the ram immediately have meaning, even though they are explained for us later on in verse 20, as the Medes and the Persians, hence the two horns of this, as it were, double-pronged power. And verses 3 and 4 remind us that they did and had, or were going to have, a sweeping conquest west, north, and south. Such was the power that, as verse 4 says, no one could stand against it. He did as he pleased and magnified himself, a sentence that summarizes a couple of hundred years of power. So it was a total conquest. And therefore the surprise comes in the next part of the vision, verses 5 to 8, when there appears a he-goat. Now later we're told, in verse 21, this is the king of Greece, and we know, therefore, that this is Alexander the Great. And it's interesting that Alexander named one of his sons Alexander Goat. And therefore, the symbol of the goat was obviously not just an accident in the vision, but something that had meaning within the Greek thinking. And some of Alexander's successors, indeed, had goat's horns on their coins. Well, that is fair enough. It's explained here for us. This is Alexander the Great. And verse 5 is a very descriptive verse. It speaks about the goat attacking without touching the ground. This is sort of a picture of someone who is traveling faster than seems possible. The whole agility. And this was true, of course, of Alexander the Great's brilliant campaign. His enemies, it's recorded on several occasions, simply couldn't believe their eyes that Alexander the Great and his armies were actually coming for them. He moved with such speed across the world, indeed reaching as far as India. And such was his speed and such was his daring in one great battle, for instance, against the Medes and Persians. They were five times as large, the Medes and Persians, in the army. He had to cross a river that they were manning. His soldiers had to go into the river and still attack, and he still won. This was the force of the man. And so Alexander the Great is symbolized here as this he-goat with one horn, with agility, sweeping across and smashing the Medes and Persian Empire just like that. It was devastated. The horns were broken off, as it says. But again, this was short-lived. And verse 8 tells us that the power of Alexander the Great didn't last long. Indeed, at the point of his most colossal power that he had, he died, actually at the age of 32, from drunkenness. I think it's worth just pausing a moment while we're looking historically to see, perhaps, that the reason he collapsed was that he put all his effort, all his power, into the venture of conquering and had little strength left for establishing his kingdom. One commentator makes the very interesting sideline, which is a sort of spiritual comment, that this is why Paul tells us that as Christians we have to be more than conquerors. They were not just people who are to conquer in the oppositions to the Christian faith, but to go on establishing those conquests in our lives. Very interesting comment. Whether it has anything to do with Daniel 8, I don't know, but it's an interesting comment, and indeed is a lesson from history, and history teaches us much. It may be also, if I may apply it, a lesson about evangelism. To be an Alexander the Great evangelist is not much use unless you go on establishing the kingdom afterwards in people's hearts and lives. Then in verse 8 come the four horns. They are the four generals who split up the kingdom. And then after that, in verse 9 to 14, comes a little horn. Now, the idea of his being a little horn is this comparison between the noble leaders, the sort of ram, the goat, the conquerors of the leaders of Persia and of Greece. And this figure is intended, it seems in the vision, to be a despised figure with no natural power of leadership or conquest. Verse 23 tells us he understands riddles, so that means he could do the Times crossword, but more than that, it obviously was a statement of his being intellectually astute and clever. So no doubt about that, but there seems to be in him no natural power of leadership. And verse 10 tells us that he grew great, which is a sort of sign that he had no natural greatness in him. This describes Antiochus Epiphanes very accurately. And let's get it clear, even that name doesn't mean much to some people, it will to others, that this was only now 175 years before Christ. That's right up fairly close to the coming of Christ. Now the irony of this vision and of what happened in history is that this little horn had more effect than the superpowers. There were five things he did, and you can see them all here. Firstly, in verse 10, he trampled on people and the saints. The stars probably means some of the leading witnesses to the faith in those days, or perhaps the leading authorities, other kings. And he seems to have used a deliberate policy of openly trampling on people and killing them to show his power. The terrible things that happened, if you've got your finger there, are described in verse 24. His power shall be great, he shall cause fearful destruction,
and shall succeed in what he does, and destroy mighty men and the people of the saints. We know that little people who have no natural power in almost any level of society, whether it's in your office or in world politics, have to win by trampling other people down or denigrating their character. And this was exactly what Antiochus did, and he, with a fearful show of power. Secondly, he attacked God, verse 11 and the first bit of chapter 12. He directed his attack against the prince of the host and on the sanctuary worship and on the daily offerings. He abused God, blasphemed God. He defiled the worship of the Jewish sanctuary, and he sought to eliminate any worship of God. Thirdly, verse 12 and the second part, he attacked truth. Truth was cast to the ground. And verse 25 tells us that by his cunning he shall make deceit prosper under his hand. So no justice, no righteousness, only corruption and a subtlety that twisted truth and achieved its ends by any means. Fourthly, end of verse 12, as so often happens, evil prospered. And fifthly, sorry to keep moving you backwards and forwards, to verse 25, the very last sentence of the verse, by no human hand he was broken. The first check on this little man who grew so powerful was in Egypt. Then he had a great illness upon him, and in the last weeks, months of his life, this man who had trampled on the saints, who had murdered people right, left, and center, who had attacked God and hated the Jews, wrote to the Jewish people, promising them many things, and even that he himself would become a Jew if, quote, God would restore him to health. By no human hand he shall be broken. And he ended with a miserable death in an obscure village. Now, what relevance is this to us in January 1981? I believe a very great amount. And I hope that by the time we end our study of Daniel in a few weeks' time, it will have emphasized and repeated sufficiently some of the major lessons of the book so that they become part of our thinking as Christian people. Let's then move in to the vision and its application. Now, we looked at verse 17, and just for the note takers, verse 19 and verse 26 also tell us that this has the long emphasis into the time of the end. And this is why the book of Revelation itself picks up on this chapter and other parts of the book of Daniel. So what are the applications to us this morning? Let me suggest them to you. Firstly, that you and I, as believing Christians, need to have a sense of history about conquering and evil powers. Look back at verse 13. The Holy One looks on to this devastating persecution that is taking place. And the Holy One does not say, why is this happening, but how long is it going to go on? Now, that's what a sense of history should do for us. Those of us who are getting on in years a bit have lived through different regimes ourselves, have seen the force and awfulness of the Nazi regime. Most of us have seen the communist revolution in China, have been sickened by Idi Amin, or what has happened in the most awful rape of people, in the murder of 3 million in Kampuchea, only just a few years ago. To me, that has been one of the most horrific things in world history in the last few years. Brutally beaten to death. All of us would have suffered that fate if we had lived in Kampuchea, Cambodia. So history is exemplified here, but what it does is that it shows us the brittleness of power. That's the force of it. Verse 7, the ram is hit and the two horns break. Verse 8, the he-goat's great horn is broken. And the proud hopes of a Napoleon or a Hitler or a Stalin or a Chairman Mao or Khmer Rouge lie in the dust. The believer learns to say, how long? And to believe that an end will come. And such hope has kept the church in China alive. And resurrection for the church in China has come sooner than even Chinese Christians expected. As I was saying at the prayer gathering on Tuesday, that our own Joyce Bennett went across to Canton on the Sunday before Christmas to celebrate Christmas as they have to work on Christmas Day. And there, for the first time in 14 years, Christians in Canton could celebrate Christmas. And there were 1,200 people packing the church and pouring out into the pavements outside. And a stream of people being baptized and confirmed for the first time, young people, for the first time in 14 years. And the weeping outdid the rejoicing. Yes, the tide has turned. So a sense of history about conquering and evil powers. Secondly, a sense of reality about evil and conquering powers. Evil rampant in a country or a society or a continent is an awful thing. And nothing in the Bible can ever make a Christian believe that a peaceful utopia is ahead for the world. It simply isn't there until after Christ's reign is established in the new heavens and the new earth. The marks of Antiochus Epiphanes are the marks of rampant evil, and they are the marks at work in our own world today and will be till the coming of Jesus. The trampling on people and on the saints. We see this, and we have been seeing it. The submission to the state or the power of force. As I say, the terrible, terrible event of Kampuchea. Or we go back a little further to the Auschwitz, to the gassing and murder of thousands and tens of thousands of Jewish people. We go to an Idi Amin and to the brutal murder of men like Archbishop Lewum. We look around the world and see what it means that people are imprisoned without trial. Or we see what happens to Christians. And Revelation 7 tells us that there will be many who will come whose robes are washed in the blood of the Lamb, who have come through great tribulation into the eternal kingdom. Or attacking God. In many parts of the world, there is restriction, as we know, on freedom of worship. Or even where there are some churches allowed to be operating, there is a campaign to dissuade young people, particularly, by not getting higher education if they submit to Christ, or other subtle means in order to dissuade them from coming under the influence of Jesus Christ. And we even see that, I suppose, to some extent in the struggle in Poland this very day. Or the attacking of truth, how a false regime has to restrict travel. It does not want its people to see what's going on in other parts of the world, to control the media and the press, or to destroy the possibility of thinking, as we know in the terrible destruction of Cambodia. All books and libraries and records of past history were destroyed. And everybody who thought or read was destroyed. And in Russia, as we know, there are some Christians in mental asylums simply because they believe in Christ. Yes, rampant evil or twisting of the truth attacks truth and uses deceit. And in our own nation, it's often perhaps more subtle. We say yes or no to a film like A Life of Brian. And yet underneath that film is obviously someone who wants to pour scorn on Christ. You don't set that up in that context and in that way unless that's what you want to do. Some Christians have gone to see it and say it's very funny. Yes, it's very clever. But why was it done? As Malcolm Muggeridge has said, we're very much like the frogs in the experiment in the water. As the water gets hotter and hotter and hotter, they don't notice it until they expire. And the force of a lot of what's going on in our own country underneath is an attack upon God and upon truth and upon the saints. Well, these marks will go on while the world lasts. And today's technological developments make the expression of them often more appalling. Christians cannot expect that Britain or the United States of America or Australia or Canada will always be at peace with freedom to worship. We would be reading our Bibles wrongly to think so. We are not the national successors to Israel. And the possibility of evil powers subjugating this nation is a reality we must face. We would be unbiblical not to face it. The Britisher thinks it can never happen, but so do the frogs in the water. And so Daniel, verse 27 in this chapter, says he was overcome and lay sick for many days because of the vision. And this chapter may cause you and me to feel the same. The prospect, with the great rapidity of an Alexander the Great, of this nation altering its course, of churches being closed, of this building we're sitting in being turned into a people's palace or a cultural museum, yes, my friends, it is a real possibility. A sense of history, a sense of reality, but then a sense of perspective. We remember, if you were here last week, that we don't get caught up just with the beasts, but also with the thrones. And this flood tide of evil will certainly come. Revelation chapter 13, I think it's worth just glancing at it. If you'll keep your finger in Daniel, please, to page 235. Page 235 in the New Testament section. Verse 4, the attack upon the Lord and his people is an all-conquering one. Verse 4, who is like the beast and who can fight against it? Verse 5 and 6, it is a blasphemy against God, his name and his dwelling. Verse 7, it is war on the saints. Verse 7 again, it is worldwide. Authority was given it over every tribe and people and tongue and nation. Verse 8, people were made to worship the false one. Verse 14 speaks of deceit. Verse 16, the leveling of all ranks to be marked with the mark of the beast. It's not a very happy picture. And often, as I've said before, to me the picture that sees this is that across the world it's like the beach where the water comes in and you think to yourself, wow, the tide's come in over there. And then, like at China at the moment, it seems to be receding out again, only to be seen coming in somewhere else. But Revelation 13 says, there will come the time before the end when the tide comes across the whole beach. Not an easy time to live through if we are here at that moment as believers. But perspective not only sees that, but it sees the thrones and takes up again, back in Daniel, if we can go back to it, that by no human hand the power of a man like Alexander was broken. And the rest of the book of Revelation is the Lord's victory, the end of Satan, the gathering in of the Lord's family, the new heavens and the new earth. And every believer has to hold the perspective of God's foretelling of evil and his triumph over it. And Daniel 8 is meant to prepare us for the worst and to lift our eyes to the best. How do we respond? Just briefly at the end of Daniel 8, verse 27. Three things. Firstly, he felt sick. That's right. I think a Christian must be realistic about the evil of the world. And we must look up to the King of Kings, and know that whatever man may do to our body, he cannot touch our soul. Secondly, he has to get on with life. He gets up and gets on with the king's business, which for him meant being a minor government official. But we can just lift it spiritually and say that in our own daily lives we must go on and live, but also live, of course, for the King of Kings himself. And then into chapter 9, Daniel now begins to take prayer seriously. And that is one of the results that Daniel, I hope, will bring in our lives and in our church. Prayer about the nation and the world.